also co-sponsored by the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies and the Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. So we have a kind of a threesome sponsoring unit. I'm very pleased to be here to do this today. I feel kind of awkward because actually introducing Amitai Etzioni doesn't feel like he needs any introduction, but I'll do it anyway. We're actually here to launch his new book, Hot Spots. Professor Etzioni recently got his PhD in sociology from Berkeley, then taught for years, a couple decades at Columbia, and then came to GW as one of our university professors. He's also a professor of international affairs in the Elliott School of International Affairs. He's also director of the Institute for Communitarian Policy Studies. So he wears many hats as he has through his entire life, having written some 20-some books overall. And so this is just another into that enormous stack. I do want to mention that we have books in the back for purchase at the end of the session. I made a mistake when I got this book. I thought I would sit down one afternoon and read it and burnt my brain out. Because actually, after I got done with it's a collection of essays really on a lot of different topics. So for example, for my interest, he has some, to talk about hotspots. I don't know if I want to give this away before you talk about it. But one of his points is that this kind of pivot to Asia, which is talked about a lot. If you think of that as pivoting to Asia because Asia is a threat, China's a threat, he doesn't really agree with that threat, and he thinks, you know, we still be paying more attention to the Middle East. So this was my original interest in this book, is looking at that Asia aspect, but he covers lots of different things. He looks at the EU, he looks at terrorism, he looks at human rights. So it's not just about hotspots, but it's about, and what isn't a hotspot, but also what are the kind of issues that we engage in those different areas of the world that are kind of the hot topics. So I think it's really hot spots and hot topics. I've given an expanded title. Anyway, I say my mistake was I thought I would sit down for a leisurely day and read through this, and then I discovered what you really want is you want to read each essay like the night before you go to sleep, because every essay made me think about a lot of stuff, and I had a hard time giving up what I was thinking about the last essay to move on to the next essay. So this is my recommendation for you. When you get a copy of the book, don't read it all in one sitting. Read every day, read one essay, and have some time to think about it before you move on to the next essay, and I think that's the only way to do this. Anyway, without further ado then, I will turn the podium over to Dr. Etzioni, and he will talk something, I don't know what you're going to say, whatever you want to say, and then we'll open up to questions.
Thanks, Ed, for setting it up and for a very appropriate introduction. You worried me there for 1 second,
yeah.
And you said people should read before they go to sleep. I thought you suggested that.
Actually, my only warning is it might actually keep you awake, so maybe you should read it before breakfast. That might be the better way to do it.
I heard you and I appreciate that. Much of this we're going to do as a conversation. I'm a communitarian. Community is and dialogue is what's all about. So I like to offer you a communitarian deal. If you move closer, then we'll have an easier conversation. And anybody needs to leave at any time. There'll be no incrimination, and the camera will be turned off, and you can leave any time. How about you come a little closer? It'll be easier to have a conversation. Well, thank you. I'll talk about the various hotspots in a moment. And as Ed very correctly pointed out, there are very disparate topics covering Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iran and China and human rights. And so, indeed, it is a collection. But for me, there is a subtext which runs through all of them. And I wanted to talk to you about it for a moment, including how I got to that subtext, to that theme which runs through the book and actually much of my other work. That is, I acquired very early in life a very strong abhorrence to violence, a very strong aversion to war and any other armed conflicts. And as we go over this, we visit the various hotspots, you'll see how that comes up in all of them. So I wanted to tell you for a few minutes where I developed the taste, in part because at least I think it's a good story, and in part because I'm so ancient. These are the kind of things you usually read about, you know, in kind of books you find in the dusty part of the library. So I was born in Germany in 1929. I mean, this is not yesterday. As a Jewish child, and then when the Nazis start showing them ugly side, my parents took me as a little child to a place called Palestine. And I was there during World War II, and things were not going well. Again, I don't know how much you're up on all the details of World War II history, but for a while, the Nazis did quite well in North Africa, had a stronghold in parts of Egypt and Libya, or what's called today Libya, and they were coming in from the Syria-Lebanon side, and the British, who at that time were basically as a colonial power, though technically it was called a mandate, they're in charge of Palestine. They're seriously preparing for the possibility that the Nazis will overrun all of the Middle East, and by the way, of course, also Britain itself. And part of their preparation was they asked the Jewish community, this was of course before the State of Israel, to send 1,000 men to be trained by the British as guerrilla fighters. So the assumption was that if the Nazis will overrun that really small piece of land which was left between them coming in from the north and the south, these Jewish fighters would take to the hills. So there are not really many hills in Israel, the little mountains, and fight the Nazis. So they trained 1,000 people like this for about a year. And then the Brits did much better. There's a famous war in conflict in Alamein, which turned the tide, and they said to these 1,000 guys, thank you, goodbye, go home. And that didn't quite sit well with the Jewish community, and they decided, you know what, we have these 1,000 people trained, why don't we keep them as our private army? And that became the beginning of an organization which is known as Palmach, which decided to fight the British. And the idea was that periods of national liberation movements in any place from India to Ghana, all over Asia and the Middle and Africa, all trying to push the colonial powers out. And the Jewish community had a similar idea that let the British go home and we'll make a homeland in Palestine. The British at the beginning didn't appreciate that, and there was somewhat of a conflict. Important detail, though, here is that Palmach decided as its strategy not to kill anybody. Now, how can you have a war without killing anybody? So, for instance, we at one night blew up, I'll explain a moment where the V comes in, 10 of the 11 bridges leading to Palestine from other states, but we waited till late at night till there was no traffic on them. In another case, we blew up a radio station in Haifa, but after we gave the British half an hour to evacuate the building. The idea really was to capture headlines rather than kill anybody, and this way bring the world public opinion to bear on Britain to retreat. There was another organization called Irgun, which had a different strategy, and they tried really to kill the Brits. They blew at one point up to King David, which was at that time hotel, headquarters of the British office, and killed a lot of Brits. So, and that was a tension within the Jewish community. So I kind of jumped ahead in the story, but what happened there, somewhere in this process of the kind of a struggle between the Palmach and the British, what they call the occupation or colonial power, was they found a card file of the Palmach, and they arrested all its members and put them in a detention camp. And so overnight, this private army basically disappeared, and the call went out in 1946 to volunteers to replace the army. I was in 10th grade, 16 and a half, and my class decided to join, and so I became a member of the Palmach in 1946. I went for a year of training, The day I finished my training, the United Nations established the State of Israel, and I think most of you know the rest of the story, a lot of fighting. In that fighting, my unit started with 1,100 people and ended up with 400, partly all my friends, and everybody I knew was either killed or wounded. And everyone I knew felt that there was a horrible mistake. That if you could just sit down with the Arabs and have a good conversation, you could resolve that conflict in 5 minutes. But somehow, there was this tension, misunderstanding, which led to all this killing. The tape, I ran the tape forward, and we're exactly the same point. Actually, if you go back and look at the maps United Nations offered both communities, the Jewish and the Arab community, in 1947, suggesting both to have a homeland with Jerusalem kind of shared by both, it's very similar to what practically everybody now is talking about, along the Green Line, little trading of territory and such. So all this killing and all this suffering and all the billions spent on arms, all this has not moved us an inch compared with 1947. So you see, from my viewpoint, any way you look at it, from a personal viewpoint, from a geopolitical viewpoint, wars are really bad news. So I came to the United States, and the first thing I did, I published two books in the early 60s against nuclear weapons, and so we go to the hotspot. So the hotspot, as Ed very correctly mentioned, one of my major concerns is this idea of pivoting to Asia. And there are two sides to it, of course. One is pivoting out of the Middle East or Near East, and the second is pivoting to the Far East. Because the pivot has a military dimension, it included sending Marines which are leaving Iraq and are leaving Afghanistan to Australia. It includes shifting naval vessels from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean. So the size of the forces moved are very small. They're basically symbolic. But the Marines are 2,600 miles away from China. And so they're not exactly set up to fight, and they're 250 by now. The Chinese has, I think, about 1.2 million soldiers. So I don't think this is set up for a fight tomorrow. But the message is, it's not simply we're going to trade more, we're going to send more diplomats, we're going to have more cultural exchanges, we send more movies, but we're going to give it a military dimension. The United States moved to strengthen its military alliances with Vietnam and the Philippines. It's encouraging Japan to increase its military spending, particularly antagonizing to China, because China has of course, a very painful history with Japan. The United States is sending partly daily surveillance plans and trawlers up and down the Chinese coast. So the subtext of all this is, we are not simply pivoting to Asia as increasing our interest or our trade or our exchange or our diplomacy, but we are going to put down our military foot. And then you get, as often happens in a situation, a parallel response from the other side. And just the way we have some parts of the military, some parts of our industry, who I don't attribute them any evil motives. I think, you know, my wife is a physician, and I see very often, you look at an x-ray, if you look long enough and hard enough, you can find some abnormalities. You don't have to worry about your fee or have some evil motive. It's just enough ambiguity, I guess, you have a conference ambiguity. There's enough ambiguity in most x-rays. If you put your mind to it, you can find something which needs treatment. It's just the same thing in our relationship to China and their relationship to us. If you look at it long enough, and you don't have to look at it that hard, you find some Chinese generals who say things which are fairly troubling and threatening. And you find China building weapons, and which can be interpreted legitimately as one day posing a threat to us. So we have that famous situation which I've seen before with the Soviet Union. We make moves, they make counter moves, and then we look at those moves, and we make counter moves, and we step on that escalator before we ask, do we have to, and where we'll do that. So my answer is that I cannot, I have no ground on which to say that I know that China will never become a global power, that it will never threaten the United States. Our record, I mean, our collective record as scholars and as futurists, it doesn't allow us to make this kind of certain statements. But I think it's quite clear that at the moment, China is terribly preoccupied with its domestic problems. It has a very rapidly aging society because of its one-child policy. It has major, major environmental challenges, recently illustrated by the smog being so thick in Beijing. The average life expectancy in Beijing is 5 years below normal because the pollution is so high. There are many other environmental challenges. It is very short on water, on energy, on raw material. It's very dependent on import. It has enormous tensions. There are a huge number of riots and protests and demonstrations every day in China. The political system has not been able to absorb the protests into legitimate challenges. Above all, there is no sign that China has any desire or taste to become the world government or the world power the way the Soviet Union did. And so any way you look at that, it has certainly some regional ambitions. But if those mean automatically that we cannot accommodate those and live happy ever after, that's the issue the book is raising. Now, so that's the one half the story, that we are prematurely, militarily pivoting to China. The other half the story is that about the last thing you can say about the Middle East, mission accomplished. And so any way you look, there are some immediate urgent threats in the Middle East. And I actually would put Pakistan at the top of my concerns. Partly all the people who specialize in national security I know agree on one point, that the greatest threat to our security is a combination of a terrorist and a nuclear weapon. There are many other threats, but this one is considered at the top of the list, anybody, at least I read, on this subject. Where are terrorists most likely to get a nuclear weapon, one way or the other? By stealing it, by attacking a base, by being slipped to them by some part of the military force? The answer is clearly Pakistan. There already have been 6 attempts, either by Al-Qaeda or by Pakistani Taliban or some combination, to penetrate the storage areas in which nuclear weapons are kept in Pakistan. The Pakistani are very reluctant to let us know where the nuclear weapons are because they fear, and maybe not completely without reason, that one day we may want to grab them. And so they keep them from us, and as a result, we're not quite sure how secure they are. They keep them, and I'll come back to this point, close to the border with India, because some of them are tactical nuclear weapons, and they want to be ready to use them against India, which means they also they are not under the central command control as they ought to be. So, for reason I also mentioned in a minute, Pakistan is accelerating its production of nuclear weapons. So, one major hotspot is to ask, what can we do about Pakistan, a very troubled ally, and its nuclear weapons? And here I think is one of the points the book makes, which I think is different from what you read in other places. I wish I could tell you that I'm right. I'm not that immodest, but I will claim that the argument we make is different from others. And here's our argument. Why is Pakistan so reluctant to help us in Afghanistan and help us secure their nuclear weapons because of India. They have a very long tradition. They had, of course, several wars with India. They several times came very close to nuclear confrontation with India. The Pakistan military and people are obsessed with India. I think it's a fair statement. And so does the other side. They fear that India will encircle them by sending its forces into Afghanistan. That's one reason they're very keen to keep control of what's happening in Afghanistan. What happened in our relationship with India and Pakistan? Pakistan used to be our ally. India used to be the ally of the Soviet Union or a non-aligned nation. So for decades, we stayed away from India and we were very close to Pakistan. Then, and that's where the interesting turning points come, the Bush administration decided that our number one challenge is going to be China, and that we need India to balance, to contain China. And it decided to tilt to India in a very particular way, to provide India with uranium and nuclear know-how in complete disregard to our long-standing commitment as part of the NPT not to provide uranium and nuclear material and nuclear know-how to countries who did not sign the NPT. Pakistan, as a result, moved much closer to China. And so I don't know that you realize that China not only invests huge amounts in Pakistan, 25 times more than what we are giving to Pakistan. So when you hear our members of Congress talking about cutting off the aid to Pakistan, maybe we should note that all it will do is the Chinese will write a slightly larger check, not much larger check. 70% of the Pakistani tanks are Chinese tanks. So in many ways, by us tilting to India, we move Pakistan away. Now, if you go back to my point, and here it all comes together, all the dominoes come together. They not all fall together, they all stand together. If we realize that there's no reason at this point to go on a war footing with China, to start lining up countries all around it to try to contain China, it's not the Soviet Union, then we don't need to tilt to India. Then we can be neutral in this conflict. And here are finally some good news. In effect, while there have been these very, very long and severe conflicts between India and Pakistan, and they're sending terrorists in each other's countries and such, over the last years, the two nations have moved much closer. There have been very productive informal negotiations between the two countries, and moving to actually some very interesting creative ways to think about resolving the conflict. I'll just give you one example. One of the major sources of tension between the two nations is Kashmir. And for many years, people suggested that Kashmir be divided along the control lines, and one part would be put to India and one part to Pakistan, which many people in Kashmir don't particularly like. They rather have their own autonomy or independence. But the Indian Pakistanis negotiating came up with a solution that I think is very creative. They want to make Kashmir what they call a soft border. It would be kept as an entity, but people basically would have like dual citizenship. They could be in India and Pakistan as they wished. By the way, a similar idea between Pakistan, the Israelis and the Palestinians, and some ideas of making a binational park in some of the contested areas. So if we would put ourselves not behind accelerating the Indian nuclear weapon program, which leads Pakistan to increase its nuclear weapon program, which drives it to China, but we put ourselves behind helping them overcome, but really is fairly close to a settlement. And we get them off having to marshal those huge troops next to each other, we would be much closer to Pakistan, which could help us in Afghanistan. So actually my point is, all the things are linked. our problems in Afghanistan are linked to our problems in Pakistan. Our problems in Pakistan are linked to the mischief we made in India. Forgive me for plain English. And India is linked to our conception about China. They all have to be treated together, and then we may move in a more peaceful direction. What about Afghanistan? I just read in the last day a book which is both enlightening and makes for good read. It's by Fred Kaplan, called The Insurgents. The insurgents are not those we usually read about in Pakistan or in Afghanistan. They're a bunch of American military intellectuals and generals who got together and rebelled inside the Pentagon and got the Pentagon to shift the direction. The leader of that group, or the first one, I'm not sure, Petraeus is the leader, but the first intellectual who kind of paved the way is John Nagle, who written a book called Eating Soup with a Knife. Please let that title sink in, because his point is it's not easy to eat soup with a knife. It's long and messy, and he argues that fighting insurgency is like eating soup with a knife. And he argues that if you compare the American army to the British army, you see that the American army is an organization is not learning. It sticks to its World War II idea. It likes to have huge amounts of tanks, fighting huge amount of tanks, fighters fighting fighters, bombers fighters, a lot of conventional troops. The World War II model, a rerun of it. That's what why we sent all these troops to Iraq and to Afghanistan. And he argued that the British, when they were dealing with the insurgency in what today's Malaysia in 1922, they understood that's not the way to find an insurgency. That an insurgency you have to fight first, second, third by getting the people to come, win over the population. And then they will help you, and instead of then having to send a lot of troops, they will do the fighting, and above all, they will rebuild a society, and then you can leave with leaving behind a legitimate government support by the people. And that strategy is known as COIN, counterinsurgency, which is, as Nagel would put it, it's 80% political, only 20% military. And kind of the key phrase is winning the heart and minds of the population. And that became the strategy which Petraeus tried to do in Iraq by turning the Sunni to support the United States, and then tried to apply in Afghanistan. And so the book is a story of how they convinced the Pentagon to move from the old to the new way of fighting. Unfortunately, my book shows in quite detail, just doesn't work. Otherwise, it's a fine idea. And that is, I'm trying to be ironic, but I guess it's not quite clear. It turns out that to win the hearts and minds of people whose family are fellow Pashtuns or Talibans, who have strong religious beliefs which the United States is offending, who think that the idea of giving women rights, for instance, is something which offends every bone in their body, who are very nationalistic in the sense that they want the United States out, who think the government we support is corrupt, who make money off being the biggest producer of opiates in the world. So winning their heart and minds turned out simply not be practical. And so the story of Afghanistan is the story of, after 10 years and $600 billion, is a story of a failed strategy. And we are now left with the question, now that we're facing a similar situation in Africa, where Al-Qaeda, which we kind of drove out of Afghanistan, is now setting up branches and offshoots and parallel similar units all over Africa and Yemen and Somalia. The question is, how are we going to deal with them? The Economist in the last issue argues that we should basically, though they don't use those words, continue the strategy of COIN, of counterinsurgency, of the hearts and minds by turning the Sahara into a prosperous region. Now think for a moment about that. In the same article they mentioned, we sunk $1.5 trillion into Iraq and Afghanistan. About the last thing you would say about Afghanistan is that it's a prosperous place, and the reason Iraq is doing somewhat better is because they have oil, but that is not available, although in many parts of the Sahara. So right back to the question which Nagel raised, we need the United States to be a learning army, but did it learn the right lesson from Nagel by trying to do a Malaysia all over the Middle East? So I just wanted to see if I can touch enough hot spots to get our conversation going, but I just want to add one more link to the story, and that is particularly controversial, but for completeness of the record, I should mention Iran, which is obviously also a place we face a challenge. The major argument I'm engaging in is with those who think that you can contain a nuclear Iran. And the argument they make is something like this. We contain Russia, the Soviet Union. They had a lot of nuclear weapons. We had a lot of nuclear weapons. There's this famous balance of terror, and nobody dared use them. Why can we not do the same thing with Iran? And the proof that this can be done is they say that Iran is devout religious leaders, they are rational people, and therefore they will not do such a stupid thing as attack somebody with nuclear weapons and then be attacked back. Now, I was in 2002 the guest of the reformers in Iran, and I spent 10 days in Iran, and I deliberately asked to be taken out of Tehran, and I visited Isfahan and Shiraz and Kashan and and I tell you, people who have strong religious beliefs, and they can be fundamentalist Christians or Orthodox Jews on the West Bank or fundamentalist Muslims, when somebody has a strong belief that God whispered in his ear and tells you to do whatever you believe God wants you to do in order to martyr yourself and then have a secure place in the next life, rationality doesn't apply. Rationality, the way we understand it, that doesn't mean they will not take into account the map or the weather or the flow of airstreams. They will attack on Tuesday rather than Monday if the airstreams are better. So we're not saying that if you have strong religious beliefs, you're oblivious to the facts. But it will make you march to a different drummer than those people who don't have such strong convictions. And I came back from that visit, there's not the slightest doubt that if they have nuclear weapons, they may either slip into Hezbollah or use them. But the notion that we can rely on the rationality is indeed a very dangerous notion. Well, at this point, I hope I said sufficient provocative things to have a discussion. And if not, I'll see if I can add some fuel to the fire. I've been entitled to answer your questions if you ask it.
We have a microphone. If you have a question, identify yourself and ask a question or add your comment.
Harold, thank you for the talk. My name is John Ward. I'm with the State Department. And I spent the second half of last year in Karachi, Pakistan. And I won't make a comment because I just keep talking and talking and talking, but when you talk about the importance, and I wholeheartedly support your statement that, that Pakistan should remain a priority, but do you have any specific policy recommendations that you can share for how the U.S. might engage with Pakistan?
Right. So if you grant me my assumptions that we agree that we do not need to position India at this point to contain China, you have to grant me this assumption. And at that point, we become more neutral, because at the moment we are tilting to India, at least seen by Pakistan, to tilt into India. At that point, we can join the informal ongoing negotiations between Pakistan and India and see if we can help them to come to resolution of their conflict, especially about Kashmir, for instance, by suggesting peacekeeping forces or any other measures they both would buy into to resolve that conflict. If you can get there, this is like the magic key which will open all the other doors, because then they can release the military from standing on the Indian border and move it to the parts of Pakistan which are terrorist riddled. They'd be less obsessed with the fear that India will occupy or send its force into Afghanistan and encircle them. So it all depends on getting us off that conflict. Now, I don't know that there is one very specific measure which resolves it, but the place I would go is join those informal negotiations, to which we will not be party as long as we are tilted to one side, and see if we can in any way contribute to the resolution of the conflict between these two nations.
Thank you, Dr. Gensio. I appreciate your talk very much. My name is Ken Dante. I'm not affiliated, but my background is in psychology. Talking about fanaticism, whether it's religious fanaticism or Maoism or a secular form, national socialism is a form. How does one deal with that? Can you deal with it rationally? Can you contain it? Is it a fire that just has to burn itself out? What are your reflections, given your lifetime, not just your present reflection, but your lifetime?
Well, it's a very, very important issue. When I join these conversations, I always feel kind of reluctant to say I really don't have an easy solution, or even a not easy solution, because some of these, let me put it more succinctly. I think the international environment is a tragic environment. The notion some of us have that if you just do the right thing or increase foreign aid, or engage, or send them a letter, or smile, or whatever, then we will come together. This kumbaya, in my prayers I hope for it, but when I'm awake I realize it's just not going to happen. And so, coming back to your point, no, I don't know that anybody can take somebody who is has a messianic complex which dictates to him go and kill other people who are the big Satan or the small Satan, and convince them that resolving conflicts in a peaceful manner will benefit all sides, despite the fact that, go back to the Palestinian Israelis, that you have 70 years of showing that bloodshed gets you nothing, but more bloodshed, you still cannot get them to sit down and even recognize each other. Now, the only sliver of good news is actually, we have seen in the last days in Timbuktu, that you use the phrase burned out, and I think that's the good news. That happened also in Afghanistan. When you let this extremist govern for a while, when they impose the Sharia in the extreme way they do, most people rise against them to the extent that they can. So the joy in Timbuktu yesterday shows you what happens when you let these groups for a while run the show. Again, what happened in Afghanistan? They invited the Taliban in when there was endless chaos and fighting and bloodshed, to get some stability. But once the Taliban really start doing their thing, the population became extremely alienated, and the Taliban were overthrown very easily in Afghanistan. The trouble we got is when we started to stay for 10 years of nation building, but defeating the Taliban was a cakewalk in Afghanistan. So I think, unfortunately, tragically, we need sometimes to let things burn out for a while before we can intervene. The same in Iran. Iran, by now, there is a whole generation of young people who are not buying the regime at all, you know. Now, under what condition will they be able to change the regime is a different question. But I think there is a good evidence to show what you call burning out takes place, but if you pay a tragic cost for it. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Nancy Berg. I was thinking that you would probably have some very good advice that would resonate well with Senator Hagel, who will be our next Secretary of Defense, I hope. And for the environment that he faces over the next 10 years, I'd be very interested in some of the key points you would make to him as he starts to get his thoughts together.
Well, I think, again, I don't know what's in his heart of heart, but if you go by the media reports, when we used to talk about the Soviet Union, we used to talk about doves and hawks, but I think when we talk about China, we talk about panda huggers and dragon slayers. So I understand that he is a panda hugger, and so in that sense, I don't have to bring to him the notion that we can be cooperative with China rather than confrontational. A current media report, that is his position. His fact that he criticized Israel, I'm perfectly fine with that. Most people who get upset about that seem to not realize how much the Israelis criticize the Israeli government. It's extremely difficult for any Americans to come close to the way the Israelis criticize the government. So the fact that he's critical of Israel, I think it's not troubling at all. I'm not sure about his position on Iran. And to the degree that he buys into the, you can contain Iran and we don't need to worry about a nuclear Iran. Or the other idea that we will, that if they are nuclear capable, that is okay, we'll watch them very closely. And if they suddenly make a dash to assemble the bomb, then we're going to interfere. That concerns me, because if you look at the history of our intelligence, including, of course, about Iraq or about scores of other places, we very, 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 very often read the situation wrong. So to sit back and allow Iran to be in a situation that it could dash quickly, some people say within days, and make nuclear weapon and say that we're going to know when that happens and have the forces lined up and ready to interfere at that point, I think is a very, very risky gamble. So I'm afraid that on that issue, as much as I understand that we need to focus on nation building at home, both for our needs at home and in order to remain a global power, and that about the last thing President Obama wants over the next 4 years is have another war in the Middle East, I'm not sure he can walk away from the nuclear developments in Iran. I wish he could.
Any thoughts on what North Korea is up to?
Well, I don't mean to be rude, but the only way I can answer this fairly is no. So I try to keep up with most things, but I really have no idea. I wish I could answer your question, but I have nothing to add about it. I just don't know.
Characterize the current rivalry between China and India? Are you it seems that there are some people say previously we Chinese built the Great Wall, now the Chinese nowadays they are kind of building a great naval wall. So what's your thought on this? Thank you.
Ed, you can you come to my help here? with the China-India relationship?
You want me to?
Yes.
The only thing I would say is, I mean, I'm learning from Professor Scioni here, is that sometimes you can't make something out of something that isn't there. Sometimes you end up producing what you fear. And I think some of the India-China problem, there is real problems between India and China, some border problems. But these are not major problems. And so to begin to posit this enormous, there has to be an enormous rivalry between these two growing powers, because they're growing powers, therefore there must be conflict. We're going to produce the conflict. So that would be more my comment, is I think learning from you, I think we could try to avoid that conflict rather than positing this as a natural consequence.
If you look at the book, there's a reference to a study by Jerome Cohen. Jerome Cohen is a professor of law at NYU, New York University. But he's the hosting the Chinese dissident who recently was allowed to leave. And he did a study of numerous land conflicts China had with all its various neighbors, including India. And he showed that a very, very large number of them were peacefully resolved. And in most cases, China, especially by the way with Russia, made some very generous concessions, really very what you would expect from just by, if you would line up the relative strengths and power of the nation. In case of India, things did not go as well as in some of the other nations. But so far, and we can see if that will apply to South China Sea or not, so far, China has been very given to resolve things through arbitration, through courts, or diplomacy, with sadly one exception is India. Michael?
Hi. Oh, I'm Sarah Voss. I'm visiting from Seattle, Washington. And my question is, from what I understand, covers facing this whole tide of spreading jihadism, and not just militant jihadism, but just the general Islamic fundamentalism, like in the streets, as public opinion, is mostly being traced to Saudi Arabia and all the money that goes to the schools that's spreading these ideas. Do you have any idea whether there's anything we should do about that?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is get an understanding of what these people feel. And here is the question. Let's look for a moment at Egypt, okay? Egypt has a huge population who lives on an income of a dollar a day. And they're basically very, very poor. They don't have running water, they have outhouses, they don't have no electricity and so on. And they see on television, though they don't of course have a TV set, but then there's one in the village square, how the other half lives. Now tell me, what are we telling them? What are our promises to them? We tell them, all right, you can have free speech now. Well, after the end of the Soviet Union, they said it's like a dog who first was muzzled and is now allowed to bark, but the bowl is still empty. And so there's really a rather similar situation here. I'm all in favor of free speech, I'm all in favor of the right to assemble and practice your religion, but when people are dead poor and have no jobs and the economy is in decline and the foreign currency is depleted and tourism is not coming, investors are fleeing, people are concerned about the most basic things in life. So what can we bring them? Some people talk about a Marshall Plan. Well, it turns out in order to, first of all, the Marshall Plan was surprisingly expensive, one of the few things people rarely mentioned. And it took 8 years and a huge investment in countries which were much better prepared for economic development than Egypt, not to mention about Sub-Sahara or Afghanistan. So basically, we don't have much we can bring. these people other than empty promises which add to their frustration and anger and alienation. Now, multiplied is not by one country, but by the youth in Yemen, in Mali, in Nigeria, in Libya, and you see the problem. Now, other people come to them and say, there's another way for you to have dignity and significance in a life of meaning. You don't need a TV set and a car and all those Western things. You pray five times a day, you grow a beard, you keep your wife in the back of the house, you abide by the dictates of the Prophet, which you can do. And we will respect you, and your place in the heaven will be secure. You see why that may appeal to that person. And we don't have anything which can unplug what religion promises them. Dignity and a life of meaning and respect, which can substitute for what Sharia or jihadism offers them. We make it too simple when we think in the most extreme, almost ludicrous version, that if you go and bring them candies and soccer balls, then they'll come and will win their hearts and minds. Or if you dig a well or build a road and give them a clinic, they will happily take us off our hands. But the next morning, they still ask the question, how I'm going to get all those things which everybody has on television, and which you promised me. You told me you're going to make my country into a prosperous democracy. And so I think what we'll have to come around and realize that religion is part of the answer. And so the best way to counter a radical Islam is this moderate Islam. But we're extremely, extremely reluctant to even talk about that. If you read from the insurgents' books, when that issue came up in the Pentagon, it was forbidden. It was a taboo. You cannot talk about religion as a factor. If you go to the State Department and talk about, for instance, when we liberated Iraq, we went and taught all the pages of the textbooks in school, which had their ideology, but we didn't know what to put instead in there. So we taught them science and math, which is wonderful, but we left empty the ideological value box. And so that is a very, very serious challenge. That's what is what Huntington mistakenly called the clash of civilization. There is a deep tension between the modern secular view of the world and the religious view of the world. And I'm not at all sure, actually, I'm sorry, let me be a little more open here. I'm quite sure that the secular view cannot win that battle. It doesn't mean you have to go to the extreme religious, but it means you'll have to support some kind of form of religious answer to people's deepest yearning.
I do a follow-up to that question. So part of what you're just saying, I think, also has to do with human rights. And one of the essays in your book is about human rights, and which I think does a very good job of trying to get down to what human rights are. You have economic rights, political rights, religious rights, and so on. But I was talking about your book with one of my students from China today, and she noticed that in the title, in a post-human rights world, and she said, well, in China, it's not really a post-human rights world yet. So I thought maybe I'd give you a chance to explain what you meant by that.
Every time I talk about the book, I include my prayers that nobody will ask me that question. And so, but what happened is, first I had a fight with the publisher who wanted to put the map of the Middle East on the cover, and which would imply that all the hotspots are the Middle East, and the book discussed China and human rights and Libya. And then they wanted to give it some other, the main title was going to be something which would put me to sleep, like international relationship in an international theory. So I won these two battles. And then they put in there, post whatever
post human rights world. Yeah.
And I just lied. Now the best I can make out of it is like this: the many discussion of human rights deals them as if they're one indivisible package. Especially when people talk about civil and political rights, people talk as you did, as the title says, talk about human rights like a package, or they say the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I argued in the previous book, Security First, and in this one, that we really should not treat them all as if they were one package. That there is one right which takes precedent over all the others, and that's the right to be kept alive. And on the extremely elementary grounds that dead people, the other rights don't speak for them. They may have a right to speak or to assemble, but they're dead. On the other hand, people who lost their other rights, but have the right to live has been respected, they can live and fight another day and hopefully get their other rights. So the first thing we owe to all people is to stop genocides, stop torture, stop maiming, stop starvation. Then we can worry about all the other stuff. And so when we go and into Iraq or Afghanistan and promise them a kind of a Western democracy, we're not going to deliver. And instead, I think we should do, but I don't like the word minimum because it's so significant, important. But that's the most basic thing. That's first of all going to Congo, into Syria, in all these places, and be sure that people, to the extent we can, remain alive. Then let's talk to them about which kind of regime they want, all the other things. So no, there is no post-human rights any place, but there's a need to treat them as they were not all of the same standing.
Okay. I think we've actually kind of run to the end of our hour. But I assume that if people cluster around you afterwards, you're willing to talk some more. We also have books to sell in the back. So I do want to thank everybody coming today, and I also thank you, Professor Etzioni, for your presentation. Still kind of warm in here. Hey, Bill.